Imagine Theater's first ever video game night takes place on November 16th at the Imagine Theater in Royal Oak. Hosted by Activate's own Bailey Ray, you can play against friends and enemies in the newest sports games on the hottest systems. Get your hands on the latest in virtual reality or enjoy retro living rooms with the systems to match. Drinking food specials including an all-you-can-eat taco and nacho bar, as well as door prizes and giveaways all night. Space is limited, so go to ActivateGaming.com/imagine to reserve your spot today. That's ACTIV, the number 8, gaming.com/imagine.
Welcome to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
Well, at least just Mike Brennan today. Matt is out on personal time, so you got me whether you like it or not. And I have on the line Maureen Miller Brosnan, who's the executive director, right? I always get titles always screw me up. So it's executive director of the Michigan Venture Capital Association. Yes, did I get that right?
You got it right, Mike.
Okay. Some are presidents, some are executive directors. But anyway, big event. You have the MVCA dinner on November 2nd. So by the time this podcast, we're live now, but by the time the podcast comes out, the dinner will be over. So I'm more interested in, rather than all the beautiful people at the dinner, more about the award recipients. Let's talk a little bit about who's getting awards. And one of them is one of my favorites, David Brophy, who calls himself the Big Kahuna, who's been doing the Venture Capital, well, it's not Venture Capital, it's Michigan Growth Capital Symposium, I don't know, 30 years now, more than 30
35,
years?
35 years, yeah.
I know, a long, long time. So he's getting what? What award is he getting?
Dr. Brophy's going to get what we call our Above and Beyond Award, Mike, and you're right. The dinner will be over by the time your listeners have a chance to catch up with this story, but the good news about what's happening in the venture capital community won't be over yet. We're still going to be celebrating a good year for venture capital here in Michigan, and you're right. Dr. Brophy leads our ticket in terms of those folks that have made a real difference in the community and the entrepreneurial world here in Michigan. Dr. Brophy is being recognized this year as the Above and Beyond Award winner for his vision. A long time ago, 35 years ago, he spotted an opportunity for investors to come together with some of the great ideas that we wanted to showcase here from entrepreneurs in Michigan, and he created the Michigan Growth Capital Symposium at the University of Michigan with University of Michigan Ross School of Business there. And as a result, every year we're able to gather people from all over the country to take a look at some of the great ideas that are coming out of the state of Michigan. And Dr. Brophy is perhaps one of the best examples of the importance of building smart entrepreneurs in Michigan. You know, Michigan has the 7th highest number of PhDs in science and engineering. And as a result of that, we've just got some great thoughts, some great minds creating great companies. And so we wanted to recognize Dr. Brophy for the light that he shined on so many of those great ideas, as well as the investors that he's been able to train and educate in the Ross School of Business. Just about every investor that started out in the state of Michigan has started out at one point in time sitting in the desk of one of his classes. So we're really excited to be able to honor him. And the event brings together the largest, not just the Michigan Growth Capital Symposium, but this annual awards dinner brings together the largest number of investors and entrepreneurs in the state every year. So we're really excited about that. One of the keys to this year's event is that we're going to be partnering with a group called AMIC, which is the Accelerate Michigan Innovation Competition. It's the state's largest competition for entrepreneurs. And in the day that they have that, which is the day after our annual awards dinner, they give away $1 million in prizes to startup companies in Michigan. So that's really another good opportunity to showcase all of the phenomenal ideas coming out of the state. And none of that happens if those great ideas don't find funding. So that's really what the awards dinner is meant to do. It's meant to shine a light on those who are bringing capital into the state. And one of the groups that we're going to be acknowledging with the Michigan MBCA 100 Award is Fontanelles Partners. They raised $100 million this year. It's the largest VC fund that was raised in the state. And they are focusing on next generation mobility, which is an increasingly growing sector in the state. So we're really excited about everything that they've been able to do this year. And then one of those companies that has been funded by venture capital and has reached success is Melendo Therapeutics. And they are being acknowledged this year as our capital event of the year. They had a $62 million Series B funding, which was the state's largest healthcare deal in 2016, making them the largest VC funding round, financing round in the state this year. And what happens when venture capitalists are able to fund great innovations like Melendo Therapeutics is that we're able to pull together money with ideas that are really helping to advance healthcare. And that's a really great example of a company that was the first in class in their disease-modifying treatments for endocrine diseases. And it's been especially important for them. And then our final great story is that of Retrosense Therapeutics. Alongside the venture capitalists, you find angel investors really growing and advancing in the state of Michigan. This year, they raised $16 million to help startup companies reach that next level of growth. And one of those companies was Retrosense Therapeutics, which was acquired for $60 million by pharmaceutical giant Allergan. And they have just formed a gene therapy that's designed to cure blindness for those that have retinal degenerative conditions. So exciting things, you know, when you get to work in an arena where you're doing everything from, you know, raising money to developing endocrine technologies to developing cures for blindness. It gives us a lot to celebrate here.
Yeah, sounds like it. And another thing that's a new wrinkle this year is you're going to be at the Rattlesnake Club instead of St. John's in Plymouth.
Yeah, and you know what? We think that that is all good news as well. It really ties in with a lot of what we're trying to do in advancing the conversation about mobility. This year, in our upcoming research report, we're going to be pulling mobility out as a sector that we are going to be studying separate from technology. And that's usually where those numbers and that data gets wrapped in. Because it's a growing industry and a growing area that we as a state really want to focus on, we're going to pull it out and study it. So it makes really good sense to move this event to Detroit, which is the hub of mobility in the state right now, and partner with the North American International Auto Show. They're another new add to this year's event as well. At the beginning of the auto show in January, they are featuring a separate exhibit called Automobility, and it's the coming together of innovation in the mobility sector along with investors. And so they're going to be promoting that at our annual awards dinner, and they're also going to be bringing with them Bob Lutz, who's going to be talking and giving our keynote address, talking a little bit about the successes of the past, but more importantly, about where mobility is headed in the future.
Yes, no, Bob. Well, I used to be the Chrysler beat writer at the Free Press when he was vice chairman. So,
yeah, we're really, really looking forward to having him with us as well. So it should be fantastic. We've already got a record-breaking crowd. It seems like every year we continue to attract more investors from outside the state of Michigan, which keeps us very much on pace with what Michigan does as a state in attracting venture dollars. You know, for every dollar that comes into the state of Michigan that's invested by Michigan companies, an additional $4.31 comes from outside the state of Michigan. So it's events like this that help us interest those investors in what's happening and what's new that, you know, that's coming out of Michigan.
Yeah, I know from your annual research report from a year ago, actually it was released this year, in 2015 there were 74 companies that received $282 million, a 48% increase. That's pretty good, right?
It's very good, especially when you look at, you know, what's happening on a national basis where venture investment is leveling out. Folks are still looking at Michigan as one of the best places to make their investment. And we really believe that it's because of this combination of research, talent, and ideas. You know, we rank first nationally in the amount of research dollars per venture dollars that go into entrepreneurial companies. When it comes to talent, as I indicated earlier, we have one of the highest number of PhDs. We're sixth in the nation there. And then when it comes to patents, we rank seventh nationally in invention patents. So, you know, we've got this, you know, this grouping of phenomenons coming together. But then you layer on top of that just the fact that it's easy to do business in Michigan. We are a community that networks very easily, and we do it well through events like the Venture Capital Annual Awards Dinner and the Michigan Growth Capital Symposium. So we make it easy to do business, and it's affordable to do business in Michigan. So you put all of that together, and we can see why Michigan's on the rise in terms of venture investment and angel investment, right alongside with the rise in the number of attendees at events like the Growth Capital Symposium and the Annual Awards Dinner.
Well, and if Matt was here, he would point out that Michigan has more engineers per capita than even California, or maybe California just nudges us out. But California has 40 million folks, and we have a little over 10. So we have lots of engineers here, right?
We certainly do. And, you know, we believe that that, again, goes right to the fact that, you know, not only do we have really smart people here in the state of Michigan, but we have really smart people that are industrious enough and brave enough to go out there and try to create new innovations and new technologies. Designed to advance healthcare, designed to advance science, designed to advance IT and mobility.
I know you don't have a crystal ball, but we are getting towards the end of the year, so I'm going to ask you to pretend you have a crystal ball. What's 2017 shaping up like for the venture community?
Yeah, you know, Mike, it's interesting when we look at 2017, and you're right, you know, we don't have anything that's going to tell us exactly how the year is going to stack up, but we do have trending data. And, you know, everything in the state of Michigan appears to be on the upswing right now. So there's really no reason to believe that we wouldn't continue to have an increase in capital under management and an increase in the number of venture firms. We've had, I think, one new venture firm enter the arena here in the past year. But, you know, all of that makes a difference.
How many venture firms do we have now, Maureen?
There are 36 that are members of the Michigan Venture Capital Association, and they represent all of the venture firms in Michigan. We don't account for any private equity. It's just all strictly venture. And people are usually shocked by that number. When we travel outside the state of Michigan, we were in Chicago earlier this year. They just can't get over that there are actually 36. And their first question is, are they all active? Yes, they are all very active companies. On average, they have raised 2.5 funds each. So they are still at their growth stage, too, but they are all active.
And then I've lost track of how many angel groups there are. I know we're pushing around 10 or 11, somewhere in that ballpark, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, we've got 10 in Michigan, and we have our first international group out of Windsor that has joined the Michigan Venture Capital Association. So that's kind of a new venue for us. But there are 10 groups that have been formed in Michigan. Again, they're all members of MBCA. They represent a little under 300, 294 to be exact, angel investors in the state. And what's so interesting about that number is that that just represents the tip of the iceberg in terms of the number of angel investors we have in Michigan. You know, those are the ones we can get our arms around because they're part of a group. There are all sorts of other angel investors out there that don't belong to groups that are out there funding startup companies.
Well, we'll have
grow that number.
Yeah, we'll have to send them this podcast and get them involved. But right now, we're out of time in this segment. We've had Maureen Miller-Brosnan, who's the executive director of the Michigan Venture Capital Association, talking about a big dinner this week and all the awards and what's going on with the group. Thanks for joining us, Maureen.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
This is Mike Brennan on M Squared TechCast. Hey, it's Mike Brennan, and my partner in crime, Matt Roush, is out today on personal time, so I'm just the only host here today, but we'll get through this without him. Excuse me. We have on the line, we have Linda Dacian. Now, again, with titles, you're the executive director of the Mobile Technology Association of Michigan, right? I don't think you're the president, right?
I'm both, actually, but
oh, okay. All right, I wasn't sure. I always get all these titles, I always get those screwed up. But Linda's been on the show many times before, and last week we were both moderators at the Tycon Midwest Conference at the Henry in Dearborn. I moderated a mobility panel on how to make money with mobility, and what was your panel?
Mine was about the technology itself and how entrepreneurs can participate in the mobility space.
Okay. So what did you think of that conference? I must admit, I could only parachute in from my segment, then I had to leave, so I didn't really... Did you spend both days there?
No, a number of members of our team did, but like you, I was only there for the parts where I was participating. But while I was there, it was a great event, and my team came back and said that they were extremely impressed. I actually got a major thank you for letting them attend this one, which doesn't usually happen.
That's because they probably went to that dinner and had all that great Indian food, right?
That could very well be.
Yeah, I wanted to get back for that, but I live in Ann Arbor, and driving back and forth on 96 into town on a Friday night wasn't something I really wanted to do, but maybe another time, right?
So, absolutely.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that in more detail. How would you say your panel went? I mean, what kind of stuff did you cover?
Well, we let ours off first. We had a speaker, actually, and his name was Paul Brubaker, and he is the chairman of the Alliance for Transportation Innovation out of Washington, D.C., and he spoke first to the group on transformation of mobility, talking about, you know, how the industry is changing, all the different types of transportation that are really starting to become the focus, and what kind of opportunities that presents for entrepreneurs to really get involved in the space. You know, for so many years, it was all about the OEMs and the tier ones, and that was pretty much what there was. But now mobility is changing so quickly to so many different types of transportation that it really is presenting a lot of opportunities for entrepreneurs. So he spoke on that, and then we had our panel, and each panel member had a specific topic area that they were assigned to. Paul joined the panel, and he talked more about the technology. Then we had Kamal Doshi from SMART at the University of Michigan, and she was talking about emerging business models in mobility from around the globe. And we had Matt Smith from MDOT, and he talked about transportation infrastructure adapting to the new mobility. And we had Elena Farnsworth, who is CEO of Mobile Comply, and she talked about educating business owners about mobility and how to find their role in it.
Yeah, I think our panel looked at the fact that the OEMs are not dominating this space. In fact, they're being forced to move, forced to work with disruptors, as it were. You have the Googles and the Apples and the Verizons and everybody under the sun that really comes out of Silicon Valley, or they come out of a technology background, and they're kind of forcing their way into the cars, whether the OEMs like it or not. So that was kind of what we talked about. But there was a lot of opportunities then for anybody in those spaces to make some money, right?
Well, there absolutely is, and that's one of the things that we've been encouraging is for companies to really start to take a look at where they can find their particular niche in the space to do something that is disrupting and innovative, to sort of carve out their own little piece of the pie. And the interesting thing is, if you do that well enough, you might actually get acquired by one of those OEMs, because that's happening a lot these days, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And from my understanding of what the consumers want, they just want their smartphone to work in their car, and they really don't care what the technology is. They just want that to be technology agnostic. Plug in my smartphone, let it work. There you go. Is that your understanding, too?
That absolutely is my understanding, and we've actually talked with some people who've done some surveys on that, and there's been a lot of analysis on that. Matter of fact, somebody I think you've had on the show in the past, Paul Jacobs from JCAPS, who their company did a survey about that, and that is precisely what consumers want. They don't want all this proprietary software in the cars. They want their Google and their iPhone stuff to work, and they don't want to have any complications. So hopefully the OEMs are hearing them.
Yeah, and the other issue is the same thing I saw. I've been covering technology for a very long time, and it's the same thing right now where you have all these different standards. And one of the things I wasn't aware of is the Chinese have a whole different set of standards. So the industry really, the world industry really needs to standardize around some format to make this simpler for all concerned, right?
Well, it absolutely is the case. And yeah, it really is truly the wild, wild west right now. And you're exactly right. And there are a lot of people having conversations about trying to standardize. But obviously, there's also some resistance to it by some of the players in the ecosystem, because that takes away their ability to have proprietary systems that, you know, they can protect and they can build on and charge for differently and that sort of thing. So we've got to find a way to make everybody happy, and that will eventually happen. It happens with every technology spurt that we have.
Yeah, I've observed this in many ways. Back in the old days when we had the 14-inch hard disk, then we had the 8, then we had the 5 1/4, and it was a battle all the way down the line on that. And then you have the Betamax battle with VHS, and eventually it all goes into a standard at some point.
Yeah, it absolutely will, and it's just going to take you know, a little bit of evolution and people doing some testing and finding out what works best for the majority of people. And it's going to have to take some analysis too, because the industry is a bit resistant to it. The automotive industry is a bit resistant to it, but eventually consumer preference does eventually win out.
Yeah, absolutely. So also, we're getting towards the end of the year. We're recording this on Halloween, so tomorrow's November 1st. So I've been asking different folks today that are coming on to kind of look into their crystal balls and kind of give me some thinking about what they're seeing shaping up for next year, for 2017, in their own particular area. And, of course, I think I lived in the East Coast for a while, right? Yours would be... if we wait long enough, my draw will come out, because I used to work in the South too. But yours is mobility and connected vehicles, that sort of thing. How do you see that all playing out next year?
Well, ours is the connected vehicles, but it's also connected health and smart cities and smart manufacturing. You know, we cover all of those areas. And I think what I see happening most is that really those other areas are starting to gain a lot more traction. For years here in Michigan, we really were only focused on the connected vehicle, the autonomous vehicle, but those other industries are now really starting to gain some traction. And what that is really doing is it is increasingly making people harder and harder and harder to find. So that's becoming a major issue that we're very focused on, is trying to make sure that we can find opportunities to get people trained so that they can be available to fill all the positions that are being created.
Yeah, that is a real key. In fact, we have a guy here today from the Workforce Intelligence Network that's going to be talking about that very issue. Hector is here, and he's going to be talking about that in the fourth quarter.
Excellent.
We had the Lions show before me, so I'm thinking I'm thinking football all of a sudden, right? So
yeah, it's an important topic, and it's something that Michigan is really going to have to deal with. There are projections that by 2020 we could have a shortage of anywhere between 100,000 and 200,000 people just here in the state of Michigan.
Yeah, absolutely. What can be done, though? I mean, again, Hector will be addressing that in the fourth segment, but what do you think can be done we're training a lot of people, but a lot of them are just for reasons that they want more exciting places to live, or going to Chicago or L.A. or New York. How do we keep them around here?
Well, there's a number of things. Number one, we need to make sure that we have the training resources available for them. A lot of them are leaving here because our educational institutions aren't really prepared to be teaching the correct things. So that's something we need to work on. Also today, actually, Oakland County has started an initiative where they're sending out a survey to employers trying to identify what are the jobs that are going to be needed to be filled now and in the future, so they can really get a better handle on what exactly those specific jobs are, so descriptions can be written for them, so training can be identified for them, so that we can do the things that we need to do here in Michigan to make sure that we are preparing people. And if we have them properly prepared and they know that there are jobs here for them, they'll stay. The cost of living is so much less here. They can have a much higher quality of life, but they need to know for certain that they can make a good living here.
Yeah, I have a friend of mine from my Free Press days who just took a job out in Silicon Valley, and she bought a 3-bedroom ranch in one of the suburbs that cost her $1.3 million.
That's just crazy. I can't even imagine paying that much for a house.
Yeah, that's
not unless it's some big, huge mansion.
There it is. I thought you had one of those already.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, you get to do a shameless plug here. Why don't you tell folks a little bit more about the Mobile Technology Association of Michigan?
Well, absolutely. We're a nonprofit trade association for the industry. We are here to help every industry that is working with connected technologies in any way. We help with education, and we help with resources and events and all sorts of initiatives designed to grow the use of connected technologies here in Michigan and to promote what's happening here in Michigan outside the state, nationally and internationally.
And if folks want to know more about your organization, what's the website?
GoMobileMichigan.org.
And do you want to give out your email address if they want to contact you personally? We won't ask you to give out your phone number or anything like that.
Absolutely. It's Linda@GoMobileMichigan.org.
Okay. Any final points? We've got about a minute left. Any exciting events coming up? I know you do Mobile Michigan Monday, right? Did I get that right this time?
Mobile Monday, Michigan.
I know I botched it somehow. So,
we actually have one coming up on the 14th of November that we're going to be focusing actually on cybersecurity careers and what the opportunities are there. We have a great panel lined up, and one of your speakers today, Hector Acosta, is actually going to be one of our presenters at that event.
Oh, he didn't tell me that. So he's right across the table from me, smiling right now. So we'll give him lots of publicity. All right, we're going to have to wrap it up, Linda. Thanks very much for being on the show today, Linda Deschant, the president, CEO, and chief cook and bottle washer for the Mobile Technology Association of Michigan. You're like me. You wear all hats, right?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Okay. This is Mike Brennan on M-Squared TechCast. We will be back with Dan Lorman with a cybersecurity update. It's Mike Brennan, and we're back with the third segment. I almost got blew that, too. Boy, it's one of those days. I needed a cup of coffee or beer. I'm not sure which. But we have with us on the line Dan Lorman, who's going to do his monthly cybersecurity update. I just saw Dan on the 17th of October because we are at the North American International Cyber Summit in Detroit. Right, Dan?
Absolutely. Yeah, great. Happy Halloween, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. You too. I know. Are you going out trick-or-treating with the kids tonight?
I don't know about that. Maybe just scare a few people at the door a little bit.
Yeah, I like to do that. When the kids come to the door, I dress up in a mask and scare them, and, you know, it's all part of the fun. But anyway, speaking of scared, yes, I mean, you're going to tell us about the bad stuff happening in cybersecurity. I guess ransomware seems to be the number one thing that I see everywhere, everyone talking about. So I think they finally get it. They just don't know how to get rid of it, right?
Absolutely. Well, I think the other big news right now, ransomware is huge, and then the big DDoS against Dyne, brought down, about 10 days ago now, the big internet outage. And a lot of talk about, you know, Internet of Things, DDoS attacks is certainly hot. But and I can mention that I've had the chance in the last couple of weeks to go to actually two summits. We'll talk about the one that we had here in Michigan and Detroit on the 17th. And then also I just last week got a chance to be in Wisconsin, in Madison, Wisconsin, at their cyber summit as well. And so we can talk a little bit about that as well.
Let's go back to that DDoS attack, though, because that's what caught a lot of people's attention that may or may not be paying attention to ransomware. And from my understanding, I did some research on that, read some reports, that it was all these unprotected video cameras and VCRs and thermostats and everything like that was harnessed into a gigantic botnet, which attacked Dyne. Is that your understanding?
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, it was the similar kind of attack that happened to Krebs. We talked, I think, last month about the attack on Krebs on Security, the blogger Krebs's website, and a lot of talk about that. And then similar types of methodology used, to really be able to attack, these DNS servers that were online, and using the Mirai, MIRAI botnet that's out there, basically code that has been shared now online to be able to attack Internet of Things devices, so Linux devices that are out on the internet, and it's a huge issue. I think there's a lot of discussion around, you know, what should happen next, and I think, you know, this is going to be kind of round two of X, and I think there's going to be certainly, you know, more to come, more DDoSes, and there's a big question as we think about this now. Of course, we're in the political season here. You know, will something be coming on Election Day? Will something be coming the day after Election Day? And there's a lot of talk about that.
What do you think might happen?
Well, I think, you know, people, there's discussion that this was a warm-up, you know, that it was kind of a, exercise that, you know, to cause confusion, or you know what was the motive? Was it just script kiddies? I think most people think that it was not like an organized nation state that was attacking, but cause confusion, cause disruption. If people want to spread distrust of the election results or that kind of a thing. I honestly tend to be more of an optimist. I tend to be someone who doesn't think that's what's going to happen. I know there are a lot of people that do think there'll be kind of attacks against Election Day or that kind of a thing. I tend to, my background, as you know, Mike, has been in state government in Michigan and worked a lot at Homeland Security in Washington around, and I know there's been a lot of work with a lot of state governments, but it's very decentralized. I think the election will go forward without, minimal disruption. Obviously, there'll be some people that have claimed that their vote didn't count or something, but I don't see that happening. But I throw that out there because there are people who are saying it, that this was, a precursor to something bigger coming down the road.
Well, and a lot of people are telling me that, well, we know for a fact that the voter databases have been attacked, we think, by the Russians, but we're not sure. But they have been attacked. But the voting machines themselves pretty much are offline, right? They're all pretty separate. We don't have to worry about things like that.
Correct. Exactly right. So it's the voter list. It's like in Michigan, the qualified voter file, the databases. And we talked about that actually at the Wisconsin Cyber Summit, that there's 30-some states that have said, ask for some kind of help from, Homeland Security in a sense of just double-checking that the systems are protected. But really it's more about the list. And, those lists are updated every day with people, dying and people being added to the rolls and registering to vote. So constantly making those updated. But the actual machines themselves and the actual voting process themselves is really not connected to the Internet. And that's why I think, an attack against, the actual voting machines is not going to happen. But I think the challenge we face is a challenge of trust and in the process. And I think it's important that we do have a good result that people can rely on. And I'm fairly confident that it will be the case.
Speaking of the Russians, of course, that was me, not you, speaking of the Russians. It seemed like Mr. Putin got a surprise announcement there. Somebody hacked his system and come up with all this information that he really has his fingers all over the Crimea situation, right?
Yeah, I'm unlike our friend Mr. Steenan, I'm a little bit less inclined to talk specifically about that. But yeah, there's been a number of reports that did happen. I don't usually do this, but I'm going to pass on this discussion because I think there's differing opinions on what exactly happened with that So I'm going to reserve judgment at this point.
Okay, well, let's get back to the dueling cyber summits that you attend. You went to Michigan, where I sat in for the whole day. We actually did a live program from there, and so the consensus was Michigan is it'll certainly in the top three of states in the country that really have a solid cybersecurity awareness, protection, all that stuff going on, right?
I agree with that. And I think, it's really clear that Governor Rick Snyder, he ran as one tough nerd. He knows, comes from a Gateway background, Gateway Computer CEO, and understands this. And while everyone, I've gone to summits all over the country and even internationally, people talk about the importance of cybersecurity, the importance of protecting data and privacy and things. Clearly he has a deeper level, and that came across in his opening keynote. There was a competition high school cyber challenge that they had, over 100 schools competing, and they had some winners. So getting more and more people involved in that. I know there's a big effort with Cyber Patriot as well, which is another round of competitions. So we're starting to see more and more schools around, younger people getting involved. The Michigan Cyber Range was there and, with testing young people in their skills. That was certainly a big theme. A couple of the sessions that I just would highlight as well. We had the CIOs from Indiana and the CIO from Ohio state governments, along with Doug Robinson, the head of NASCIO, the National Association of State CIOs, talking about recent surveys around the country and what's happening in all 50 states. And as you mentioned, Michigan is near the top of that in a lot of categories. I think as far as, there are certainly big challenges, the same challenges that you were just mentioning in the last segment about an upcoming event on hiring cyber talent. I think that's a big challenge in government right now, keeping cyber talent, hiring cyber talent. I think budgets continue to be much lower than they are in, say, banking or in the private sector in many cases. So there continue to be ongoing threats that like the election that are getting national attention. But I think there were sessions, about 800 people I think overall were there. I don't know if you heard the final number, Mike. Somewhere between 700 and 800. I didn't hear the final number attending. So it's about the same size as previous years. It's grown several years in a row, and I think it's about the same size as last year. Great facility down there in Cobo, downtown Detroit. I just thought it was a great event, and I think it really does show, if you look at the cyber summits, around the country, certainly ours, if that's a measure, public and private sector interest, certainly Michigan's is in the top tier of that. Thus the name International Cyber Summit, really kind of setting it apart.
And the Wisconsin Cyber Summit, was it somewhat similar? Say that fast three times.
It was a good event. It was in Madison, Wisconsin, and the governor Walker was there to kick it off. He's a really good speaker and talked about the importance of cybersecurity in Wisconsin and a lot of different it was on the UW University of Wisconsin Madison. It was on their campus right there. I think it was about less than half the size, maybe 200-300 people there. Still very interested audience, similar mix of people, public and private sector. There was military and veterans affairs there. I just was going to highlight one session. I did a keynote on Internet of Things. One of the other speakers that I really liked was a guy by the name of Dr. P.W. Singer. I know he's written a couple books. You can look him up, people online. But really talking about the future of technology and geopolitics. And he listed, I just mentioned real quickly here, four reasons why he thinks that Internet of Things and IoT are huge challenges. The first one being that manufacturers of IoT devices are not computer security companies. They don't see security as their primary role or responsibility. Number two was the liability landscape is totally different with connected devices in the IoT world. And what he means by that is, historically, if you're making toasters or you're making, home kitchen appliances, you worry about a fire starting or something going wrong. Well, what if now in this new world of a connected, microwave or refrigerator or toaster, that could now be used to attack other devices or cause problems? It's a whole different liability landscape. Number three was manufacturers continue to prioritize convenience over security. So it's kind of that first to market, the desire to be that Christmas present under the Christmas tree, that toy that's connected, but that camera in that toy with your kids, may be taken over, and then, that camera is used against you, right, for, kids and things like, baby monitors and that kind of a thing. And then lastly, there are few incentives currently to get security right that we really don't have a lot of incentives for the IoT manufacturers to do the right thing. And that could lead, which is some people I know will scream no, but to regulation. There were calls after this recent attack that we started this segment on. There are calls by a lot of individuals and, even Congress for, should there be regulation, should the FCC, should others, look at IoT devices and have more standards and mandate certain things. So I know a lot of people are against that. That hasn't worked in the past. But I think if we continue to see, DDoSes and attacks and IoT devices being taken over, that the likelihood is that in 2017 and beyond, we're going to start seeing more regulation in the space.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. We're out of time in this segment. That was Dan Lorman, security mentor, former chief information security officer at the state of Michigan. This is Mike Brennan on M Squared TechCast. Mike Brennan, and we're back on the final segment of M Squared TechCast, and I'm flying solo today. Matt is out on personal time. Hopefully, we'll have him back next week. And I have with me Hector Acosta, who I'm going to promote him to director of research, but he told me I shouldn't be doing that. So actually, he's a research analyst at the Workforce Intelligence Network of Southeast Michigan. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Mike. Great to be on.
So I know what it is, but I bet a lot of folks are going, what did you just say? Why don't you tell us what that is?
Sure. So the Workforce Intelligence Network for Southeast Michigan, we're a partnership of six Michigan Works agencies and 10 colleges in the Southeast Michigan region collaborating to create a comprehensive and cohesive workforce talent system. So we do a lot of that with labor market research and trying to understand what's going on in the labor market and then relay that information to our partners and the general public to get a better understanding of what's going on, what jobs are trending, things like that.
And you just came out with your second quarter report, which I highlighted at mitechnews.com. But why don't you give us the main points?
Absolutely. Yep. So we produce these quarterly reports for our board and the general public. And actually, fun fact, it's 2,700 pages annually of labor market analysis.
That sounds like fun, all
so
right.
So a lot of information.
Wow. And yeah. You produce all that yourself? Or?
Correct.
Holy cow. I hope they're paying you a lot of money for that, right? We'll have to get you a raise. All right. So talk a little bit about what we got in the second quarter report. Now, it was very, very good news, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of good information coming out. So the employment has continued to grow. It's been doing that for the last few years. We're up to a little over 2.6 million people now working in that 16-county region in Southeast Michigan, whereas the labor force jumped by 35,000 individuals up to 2.75 million. Now, the employment rose a little bit faster than the labor force, and so that helped the unemployment rate go back down, and we're actually seeing a historical low. The average was 4.5% for quarter two. So we're sort of reaching full employment when you're in that 3-6% range, which is can be good and bad news. So
dries up wages after a while.
Right. And so that's the thought process, is that at full employment, when you have that low unemployment, wages should be rising 3-3.5%. Right now they're going up a little bit, not quite at that rate yet. So we'll have to see if that talent pool continues to dry up.
I remember from my Economy 101 class at the U of M that 3% is pretty much considered full employment.
Right. Which is that's a difficult point to reach.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. So all this was great news. What are some of the hot jobs? We talked about earlier, if you're a cybersecurity expert,
yeah,
you can write your own ticket pretty much.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, you have a lot of hot jobs in IT engineering. Actually, one of the most in demand right now is truck drivers
really?
As well.
Truck
I know
you
were talking about mobility a little bit earlier. Registered nurses is also very much in demand. So yeah, in the IT sector, you're going to have software developers for applications, computer systems analysts, which is going to be more of your cybersecurity realm. And then for engineers, you also have mechanical, electrical, and industrial engineers.
Well, all the traditional IT jobs. Getting back to truck drivers, mm-hmm. that kind of stands out. So why truck drivers?
Yeah, so truck drivers is a little bit interesting. So there's a few different things going on. One is that so when we're talking about job demand here, we're looking at online job postings.
Uh-huh.
And this is sort of the new wild west of real-time labor market data. So what we do is we work with a great company called Burning Glass Technologies. And what they do is basically send spiders all across the web and pull online job postings. So that can be either from an actual company website. It could be from a posting site like Career Builder. And they aggregate all that information together for us to analyze very easily. And so these aren't necessarily job openings, though. So not
job
every
postings.
Right, not every job opening, not every job posting is going to correlate exactly one-to-one to a job opening. So what's going on with truck drivers is the posting intensity for those are very high. So the average.
Big turnover?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a few things. There's turnover. You also have people, they get their CDL license. They think they want to be a truck driver. They're promised these very high wages, which is actually interesting. We can dig into the job postings and analyze the advertised wages. And for truck drivers, they're fairly high. One of my colleagues actually recently wrote a blog about that, comparing the actual wages that truck drivers are earning compared to the advertised. So the truck driving companies are sort of promising a little bit more than they can actually offer. And once people realize that, you know, they're no longer interested.
And the nurses thing, well, a couple things going on there. Obviously, baby boomers are getting older. They need more care. And it's a big burnout profession. I know a lot of nurses, and a lot of them just can't do it anymore, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny. We look at employment over time, starting back from 2001 for all these different groups that we analyze. And we always joke that if you ever want to be in a recession-proof job, go into healthcare.
Yeah.
Because that's the only sector that we saw that had no drop-off between 2008 and 2011. And another thing that's pretty interesting that's happened recently is hospitals now require a certain portion of their registered nurses to have a bachelor's degree, whereas that used to not be the case. And so now when you have older nurses retiring, they need to replace that with someone with a bachelor's degree, and that's a little harder to attain.
Yeah, usually a lot of the nurses I know get the 2-year degree, a licensed practical nurse, I think it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's sort of along a career pathway.
Yeah, though. Yeah, and then some of them, most of them were getting RNs, but BA nurses, or BS nurses actually, were pretty unusual in my day because I lived in Grand Rapids. There's a lot of nursing schools there when you go to the bars and stuff. And you run into a lot of nurses. But you know, bachelor of science nurses were pretty unusual. But now it's the common thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So what are you looking at for the third quarter? I know I don't have the report right in front of me, but I see you have your computer open. So what are we looking at for the third quarter? What kind of trends?
Yeah, so the jobs won't change too much. The in-demand jobs you typically see the same sort of jobs. So that just indicates that, you know, these Southeast Michigan employers are having difficulty finding that talent. So they're continually posting quarter after quarter.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of looking at the employment actually only went up just a couple thousand. Now that could just be because September data hasn't been released yet.
Mm-hmm.
But what is good news is the labor force increased quite a bit by over 30,000 individuals. Now what that's caused, since those two are part of the equation that come up with the unemployment rate, the unemployment rate did go up a little bit, but it's really nice to see that more individuals are entering the labor force. That means the talent pool is increasing a little bit. Employers have more options in terms of hiring, and hopefully some of those people then going into Q3 and Q4 will get those jobs.
Yeah, speaking of Q4, now Q3 ends obviously on September 30th. That data hasn't come in yet. But we're moving into the Christmas season here, and I see job postings everywhere for, you know, it's obviously holiday labor, temporary labor, but hey, it's a job, right? You know?
Right.
So what do you think is going to happen around Christmas time? Is it going to be really hot?
Yeah. So in addition for Q3, which is really when you have that holiday hiring because everyone wants to get everyone in and trained before the busy season, November and December. So we actually saw a record level of of job postings in Southeast Michigan with over nearly 150,000 postings.
Wow.
During Q3. So that's July, August, September.
Retail type, and that's a kind of things.
Historic record, right. And it's actually across the board in all of the different occupation groups that we look at that there was an increase. So it's not just those part-time jobs. You know, there are more IT jobs available. There are more engineer jobs available. So it's good news across the board.
Ah, interesting. Tell us a little bit more about the Workforce Intelligence Network. I'm going to let you do the shameless plug now. So I know you guys look at all this employment analysis, things like that, but what else do you guys do?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, we're that collaboration partnership between those colleges and workforce agencies. We also work with a number of economic developers and other organizations that are trying to improve the talent system here. One exciting thing that we're doing is called My Bright Future, which is a branch off of WIN, so to speak. And it's an effort between K-12, workforce development, and other partners to help students better understand what opportunities there are out there, specifically in Southeast Michigan. I know one of the previous callers was mentioning that 100,000 to 200,000 possible shortage in workers, and this is really what they're driving towards. So, because I'm sure as you're familiar, if you ever took an assessment test when, you know, maybe you're in eighth grade or freshman year of high school, you take an assessment test.
That's so far back, I can't remember. So,
but you take one assessment test and it says, okay, well, maybe you're interested in this. And then that's the end of your discussion of your career, you know, career choices. And so what My Bright Future does is it tries to develop a system where you're continually learning more about your career choices. And so right now, it has the potential to reach over 300,000 students in the metro area. And there's already 200 companies signed up. And basically, so in addition to doing these sort of assessment tests, they can then reach out to employers or workers in those fields that they might be interested in. And the one really scary thing that we're learning as we're looking at this, because of all these, you know, high-T engineering jobs, the number one job that students wanted to go into was a professional athlete.
Yeah, so, that's a
I know the Lions might have
path.
A few openings.
That's like 1% of the athletes actually make it to the pro level. Right. And how long do they last once they get there, right?
And I know, in these presentations, my colleagues, you know, they have this PowerPoint showing the possibilities of you actually becoming a professional athlete. So we'll have to see if that...
Yeah, it's probably the same probability of getting struck by a lightning twice in the same day or something like that, right?
Just about.
So cool. And if folks want to learn more about these programs, I know you have websites, but go ahead and tell the folks where they can go to find those websites.
We do. So our website is win-semich.org. So that's win-semich.org. We all have our reports publicly available. We also have some exciting labor shed reports, which we produced recently, showing the commuting patterns of Southeast Michigan, which are very
interesting. Yeah.
In fact, 92% of the workforce of that 16-county region that WIN is, 92% of the workforce both lives and works in that area. So that's why you really have to think about it from a broader perspective, and that's why we do this. Analysis.
16 counties, how far out does that
extend? So that goes up through the Thumb, west towards Genesee and Shiawassee, then down to South Central Hillsdale area, and then sort of closing that box down in Monroe.
And so Washtenaw County, Ann Arbor?
Yep, Washtenaw, Livingston, the Tri-County area, the Thumb.
Now, the other thing that I do remember from the report that struck me was 56% of the state's workforce work in those 16 counties.
Especially that Tri-County area as well as the Ann Arbor region, you know, really drive a lot of jobs, and that's where a lot of the job growth you've been seeing that there.
Well, I certainly know it's driving up the rents in Ann Arbor. I'm seeing rents in downtown. I mean, gosh, kids are paying $2,000 a month for an apartment in downtown Detroit. Who would have thunk that, right? So, all right, cool. And My Bright Future, is that mybrightfuture.org.com? What is that?
Yep.
The website, I mean.
Yep. So it's mybrightfuture.org.
Okay. Any other things you want to talk about since I got you here and you're Mr. Statistics?
Let me see. I know previously one of your callers was mentioning you were interested in the number of engineers you were talking about. Relative to California, I can't speak for California, but I will say that in a lot of the engineering occupations, you have anywhere from 2 to 6 times the number of engineers. So there definitely is a bevy of talent here, and it's just making sure that we can continue to keep that workforce strong here.
We're going to have to end on that note because I'm getting the sign from Jessica here, my engineer. That's Hector Acosta, who does research for the Workforce Intelligent Network of Southeast Michigan. We also had on the show Maureen Miller-Brosden from the Michigan Venture Capital Association, Linda Deschant from Mobile Technology Association of Michigan, and Dan Lorman, our cybersecurity expert. And that's it from our show today. This is Mike Brennan. Matt will hopefully be joining us next week, but you've been listening to M Squared TechCast.
Thanks for listening to M Squared TechCast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. Join your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan, next Monday at 3 p.m.
If you can't listen live, audio podcasts of the show can be found at podcastdetroit.com.